We had an economist in our group, Basil O'Leary, who's the chairman of an economics department in the Midwest, and a clinical psychologist from Boston, Tony Mullaney. We had a mathematician from the university in Twin Cities, several veterans, a couple of high school teachers, the operator of a house of hospitality, former insurance executive who had gone through some big changes and who had finally gotten into this kind of thing from Milwaukee. I don't know, it's hard to describe the group just in terms of labels. I think of them more as persons.
Well, the obvious objection that came from a lot of people in and out of the movement is that by burning draft card records, more than anything else, you alienate middle America, so-called.
I think that the actions of property destruction are more neutral than people think. There's a lot of acceptance of for example, in American society, of union violence. I've run into many people who have been union activists who, for example, are critical of the amount of nonviolence in the movement. I think people do not have a canned response to property destruction. It depends what the property is, who destroyed it, for what purpose. The important thing is how you communicate the action, its meaning, its purpose to the community.
Well, were your motives communicated to the community? I mean, I would suspect that the mass media did a very bad job of it and more or less said a bunch of commies or something of the equivalent invaded draft card offices and terrorized the staff workers. I would imagine that's what the mass media reported at the time. So, you know, were you indeed able to communicate your motives?
I think so. It took time. We had a very good coverage in some sense of the word in the Wisconsin area, and we had some good national coverage. The thing was it was an act of guerrilla theater in some sense of the word. There was a certain aspect of expressing the thing in theatrical terms. We took the records out during daylight hours after the offices had closed, and there was a little triangular square across the street from the building that was dedicated to America's war dead. We had arranged, without telling the press what they were covering, to get press there so that there were television news crews and working journalists present when we came out of the building with the draft records in big sacks. It was a ceremony of burning them. We stood arm in arm around this huge fire, singing, and I think we communicated as we intended to communicate, and as we in fact felt, a very celebrative attitude. The big picture on the front of the Milwaukee papers had the headline over it, "Protesters Sing as Draft Records Burn," and both the local and the national television news coverage focused in on our singing around this fire. And the joyousness was certainly communicated. We had occasion during the trial to see the videotapes several times, and I was really impressed with how this came across, as just in terms of theater, that we got across what we wanted to get across and what we felt. One of the guys in the group with the longest beard, John Higginbottom, was jumping up and down and singing "Ding Dong, the Witch is Dead," you know. And that was really a kind of how we felt. We worked for months. We got it. We made real headway into the Milwaukee community. And at the time that the trial took place, there was really a warm attitude in the community from many quarters toward us. One of the police pointed out to a reporter during the trial that Milwaukee was as proud of its draft record burners as it was of its beer. We were flooded with mail from people in the community while we were in prison, and at least 95% of it was supportive. people in the community who were laborers and teachers and housewives and so forth loaned us their life savings, literally to the penny, and came with certified checks to help get us out of prison. People in the there were firemen and policemen who signed the statement supporting us that appeared a couple of months or months later in the Milwaukee Journal. The Milwaukee Journal itself, very hostile to us, the beginning of the action, at the time of the trial, recommended that we not be sent to prison. Said, well, we don't really approve of what they did. This is not the way to go about it. But we've come to know these people. We've come to know that their nonviolence is important, and that if we can respond affirmatively to this kind of action, then perhaps we can ward off the obvious consequence of locking these kinds of people in jail, and that's to turn other people on to real violence, to bomb throwing, and to anonymous acts of destruction. So I think, you know, there was a real progress there, and that there are still some opportunities to develop these kinds of things, although I'm in favor of continuing experimentation.
You did not deliberately go underground, quote-unquote, to evade the FBI or arrest, did you?
No, I did not.
I bring that up because Dan Berrigan did, and probably by the time this gets on the air, Dan Berrigan's theatrical underground may have escaped the memories of many of us, but perhaps you could tell us a bit about why you think Dan Berrigan, a Jesuit priest, went underground evading the FBI for 4 months. What was the point of it all?
Well, I think people have to remember that nonviolence is not a system. It's a kind of consciousness, and nonviolence is a very bad word for it. It seems to suggest a kind of passivity and non-imaginative, no saying. I will not be part of this, or I will not be part of that. I will not be part of the war. I will not be part of the draft. I will not be part of the court system. And it's all these things that you won't have anything to do with, that kind of attitude. In fact, it seems to me it's nonviolence has to do with finding ways to dramatically communicate to people in a way that is convincing that life is sacred. One of the almost inevitable consequences of that is that you do nothing which, in terms of hurting or causing suffering, would invalidate the idea that life is sacred. So one can come up with a very simplistic statement that nonviolence is refusing to hurt people, but that's merely an aspect of nonviolence. It's finding dramatic, effective ways of communicating to people so that they will believe it and be turned on to it, that life is sacred, precious, can be developed, can be incredibly beautiful. Okay, with that in mind, nonviolent action has always to retain a spirit of surprise and experiment. If it just becomes the system, well, you select unjust, you locate unjust laws, you select from those unjust laws those that are most unpopular or most demonstrably evil, you refuse to cooperate with those, and then you go through the judicial process and you voluntarily accept imprisonment. The system is ridiculous. It becomes one more occasion for boring people. Seen that before, so here it does again, and here it is again. I think of nonviolence. I think in almost the same breath of a line from W.H. Auden, which he says, "Prohibit sharply the rehearsed response." It could easily be Dan Berrigan's line. At that moment when he was planning to turn himself in and had his toothbrush in pocket and was ready for the marshals to come and grab him up in Ithaca at the Festival of Life, a group of a very, and this is so almost necessary in understanding who Dan is as himself a kind of theatrical person, a poet. The Bread and Puppet Theater person or persons came up to him in costume. It happened to be a costume of one of the apostles, and said, "Dan, come. Let's don't stick it out here. Let's split." And right away. You know, he was in the costume and out the door, and the lights were out, and he was in the van truck and away. It was saying, yes, this is okay. This, for this moment, is fine. And following that thread through and trying to keep it alive and trying to get away from the rehearsed response. It was at that point that almost more than ever, the public woke up and became interested in what was happening. You know, because we are a drama-oriented society, we are easily bored, and we don't respond to the familiar. We respond to the surprising, and we learn during surprise, and that's what Dan did. It's not, that would not be my way of surprising people. You know, but it's his.
Right. A couple of observations about Catholic, rather Christian revolutionaries such as yourself and Dan Berrigan. You do not employ, it seems, any violent rhetoric. And at least Dan Berrigan said that nevertheless he is very much in tune with the Weathermen and the Black Panther Party, who have adopted a violent rhetoric, an anger about them. You do not to have an anger about yourself, neither does Dan Berrigan. You stress joyousness, whereas the Weathermen and the Panthers seem to come across with a very angry, angry thing about them.
Yeah, right. Well, people speak out of their experience. I've been very lucky. I've had not very much money in my life, but I've had some incredibly together people come into my life at various points. They've turned me on. I'm not a revolutionary because my father was. In many ways, I don't think he is or was. You know, but if I'm a revolutionary, it's because people have, by the way that they have lived, by the way that they have related to me, by their own humanness, communicated to me an alternate possibility, radically different than the culture we're now a part of. I'm very happy about that possibility. They didn't scare me into that possibility. Fear had nothing to do with it. As a matter of fact, what they were constantly doing to me, you could say looking at it in one way, was to take fear out of me, to relieve me of the burden of fear that the society has been laying on me from the beginning of my life. Taking that off brick by brick from my back and saying, you don't have to be so afraid, and you don't have to communicate fear to other people, and that, in fact, the whole process of fear making is what we're having a revolution against. We want to get away from a fear-oriented, fear-controlled society. Now, it seems to me obvious, even though I've never been a farmer, that you get what you plant, you know. People have planted certain things in me, and it comes out, you know. Right now you're speaking to 1,000 people who have entered into my head, you know, and they're part of me now. They turned me on, and they in turn were turned on by other people. In a way, you know, it goes all the way back. So I use the same method. I figure that if I got turned on this way, that maybe some other people get turned on the same way. That seems likely to me, and that's the way that I function. And it would be very unnatural for me to try to scare people into a revolution. That's just not my way.
And yet, nevertheless, don't you see a contradiction between cooperation between the Christian nonviolent revolutionary and the violent revolutionary?
Yeah, well, I don't think of myself as a Christian nonviolent revolutionary. I happen to be very much a student of Christ. I also happen to be a student of a lot of other people. Some people refer to me as a Quacklick because I'm heavily into the Quaker thing, too. I don't refer to myself as anything. But in terms of cooperating with people, it would be... It's impossible not to cooperate with people who are in any way responding to injustice. And it would be absurd for me to be judgmental about the fact that some people are into violence, because just as I've been turned on to people, I've been turned on by people who were nonviolent. It's not their fault that they, you know, were turned on by people who weren't. It's not their fault that they were raised in communities in which violence is the way of life, and that there is almost no experience to the contrary. I just can't understand how I could not be supportive of people who have been kicked around and who are refusing to be kicked around any longer.
You were a draft counselor for a while.
Right.
What was your experience there?
Well, I did draft counseling for a period of years, not constantly, but almost every day there was some draft counseling. It helped me to understand how deeply wrong conscription is. It became much more than an abstract notion to me that conscription is a lousy thing. At the same time, I've increasingly came to feel that as useful as it is to tell people what the alternatives are to the draft, that the draft itself has to be fought, and that cooperation with it is maybe a necessity for a particular person, but it requires as many of us to oppose it as completely as possible. You know, we've really got to oppose conscription with every part of ourselves if we want to end it. So I got into draft resistance instead of telling people how they, you know, could cooperate with the draft in ways that didn't require them to kill or be killed.
A number of complaints on the part of white draft counselors has been that most of the people they have been helping have been white middle class people and not at all helping the person who's born in the ghetto, the minority group person.
Well, it depends where you put yourself, who you are, what languages you speak, and what your background is. I don't think that the movement has done enough by any means to cooperate with third world persons in the New York community, for example.
Why is that?
I think it's because they know for a fact that they can communicate best with the constituency they come from, and so they tend automatically to communicate with that constituency, and that not enough time has gone into creating alliances with other constituencies, and that's, I think, now...
Are there other constituencies in the ghetto?
Sure. I live in East Harlem, and there are people in East Harlem who are very into draft resistance and to things very close to draft resistance, who are very into anti-war things. The Young Lords are but one of a number of examples of this. And they're very open to cooperation and mutual assistance relationships. Mayor's House, of which I'm a member, has cooperated with Young Lords in the breakfast program. We have been also involved with the Black Panthers in cooperative relationships in East Harlem. We've also been into cooperative relationships with a number of other radical or near-radical organizations carrying out various services.
You've already done so, but what is Emmaus House and what is it into?
Well, Emmaus House is a work collective of about 10 people, about half women, half men, some priests, some laymen, a couple of nuns. It's a mixed thing. Most of them come out of a Christian background, and most of them have in common a long-term experience with radical education, radical organizing, education, and things of that nature. We're presently trying to be part of a more effective, nonviolent, radical movement in this area. That's what we're into now, and our work collective has that in common. We've divided up our concern into areas of responsibility: radical education in terms of nonviolent formation in the use of nonviolence, the attitude of nonviolence, the structuring of effective nonviolent responses to various key points of resistance, and the establishing of alternatives, insofar as it's very hard to become part of the of the resistance movement unless you have a way of sustaining yourself and taking care of the needs that are common to us all.
I think one thing that perhaps here should be noted about Emmaus House is that when it first opened, it seemed, although claimed to be ecumenical, it seemed like basically a radical Catholic organization, radical in terms of religion as opposed to politics, although politics was very much involved in it. There were the underground liturgies and the like, and as a result of this, there were articles in the New York Times, the New Yorker, Time Magazine, Newsweek, and the like. And Emmaus House seems not to have let that publicity go to its head, and as a matter of fact, has tried, it seems to me, to offset any effect of that publicity. What I mean to say is, as you well know, that it was more or less advertised in the mass media that they had underground liturgies
right,
Sundays, and hence you were besieged on Sundays by hundreds of people who were merely curiosity seekers.
Yeah, well, we don't do that anymore. We don't have these so-called underground liturgies. If we have any kind of ritual celebrations, they tend to be spontaneous, and they tend to come out of work that we're doing together. It doesn't make any sense to me to have people come together for, you know, to break bread who have nothing else in common but the breaking of bread. And that's okay. I've nothing
right.
against it. It just doesn't turn me on personally,
right.
and I don't think it turns on our community, and we just don't do it anymore. And we also don't think of ecumenism, as it's been called, as being a terribly important priority right now. We've got, you know, the real problem right now is what do you do about the fact that hundreds of millions of people are suffering unnecessarily and are being deprived of an opportunity to fully experience themselves or their own potential as human beings? What do you do about that fact? Does it begin to help simply to get the Methodist Church and the Catholic Church to accept each other as Christians? I mean, what point? I don't understand the point of that. That doesn't seem to me to be even a small step in the right direction. If Methodists and Catholics want to work together to do something about that unnecessary suffering, which we sometimes call violence and sometimes call oppression and sometimes call injustice, let them do it and see what happens to their churches and the consequence of so doing. But not to consider that a worthy objective, just to kind of build a tunnel linking their two churches. That just isn't where it's at. So we're not into that anymore, I'm delighted to say. We're into that other area, and out of that, a lot of ecumenical things may happen, but it doesn't matter to us whether it does or whether it doesn't.
What else are you into? What is the Appleseed Collective? What is the Quaker Project? Can you get into that?
Well, one of the things that I got into very quickly after getting out of prison, coming back to New York, was the Quaker Project on Community Conflict, which is down on 2nd Avenue, just south of 14th Street. The main thing that they are doing, although they're doing a lot of things, the main thing is training people in the techniques of nonviolence that are often needed in various crisis situations, either in terms of demonstrations or in terms of interpersonal relationships. Family, school, etc., as well as the streets. They're training people in the techniques of nonviolence. They're also using methods of turning people on to why these techniques are effective, why they work. It's making evident a lifestyle without wrapping out in lecture fashion that there are alternate possibilities, that violence is oppression, that oppression in all its forms is violence, that that if you are against oppression, you have to be against violence ultimately, that's the That's the logic and rationale and the inherent reality that you have to accept. But approaching this in terms of creating experience situations in which this becomes evident to people through experience of themselves, experiences with each other. And in a way, it's a fusion of sensitivity training with radical education.
It would seem that if you don't believe in violence, that there is very little hope of you ever seeing your goals realized, and that you may, in, you know, maybe generations, if ever, before your goals are realized. Wouldn't be violence be quicker?
If you view violence in terms of its immediate results, violence is often incredibly effective. You can kill your enemy, for example, and obviously that particular enemy is not going to bother you if he's dead. Or you can terrify people into leaving you alone or into doing things for you that you want them to do, for at least a time, for the time being. But I think that when you look at the momentum of violence through history, you have to observe that every solution leads to a far more dangerous situation. We defeated the Nazis during World War II, but in all too many ways we now resemble them. We have become more dangerous to humanity than were the Nazis. Incredible as that seems, I think a cold analysis of the number of people we're killing and the power that we have in terms of potential murder is just extraordinary, far worse than anything the Nazis had at their disposal. It's only the myopic analysis which demonstrates the effectiveness of violence. When we look over a period of decades instead of months, I think something else becomes apparent. Whether or not it's still possible to reorientate ourselves away from the violent responses is a major question which I can't answer. All I can say is that it seems to me inevitable, if we do not develop nonviolent responses, that we live on what is soon to become a cinder. That the alternative of nonviolence is by no means a winner. It's just a possible winner. It's a long shot. What isn't a long shot is that if we don't find a nonviolent alternative, history is rapidly closing its doors on us.
WBAI New York.
And that's why it seems to me important that those of us who call ourselves pacifists or advocates of nonviolence become far more effective in developing our insight and communicating its importance than we have been in the past. I think I'm not very proud of the history of the movement that I'm a part of. I'd like to be proud of it. I think we could be proud of it. And that's where you get to the next part of your question, this Appleseed thing, where you have Emmaus House and the Catholic Peace Fellowship and the Jewish Peace Fellowship and the Episcopal Peace Fellowship and the Merton House and the Buber House down on 3rd Street and the Village Peace Center and United Farm Workers Organizing Committee in the New York region. The Quaker Project and other groups cooperating in this area for the first time in terms of radical education and in terms of nonviolent direct action.
Well, will the Appleseed Collective be a sort of alternate university?
Well, if you think of a university as something other than a place of study, research, reflection, and publishing, then perhaps that would be okay. It's a center out of which activity would come, and this is not, I guess, what most people think of as a university as being. So we shied away from calling it a university. We just called it Appleseed. Period. Appleseed. The one aspect of it has to do with study, formation, blah blah, all that kind of thing. And another aspect has to do with what do you do with that information. You know, like the Chinese fortune cookie message that I got shortly before we burned draft records said, action is the proper fruit of knowledge. You know, it's a very profound statement. I accept that Chinese fortune cookie. That's what education is about, preparing people to act on what they learn. That's what Appleseed will be doing, is already doing. We have a course at Alternate U. We've got a bunch of courses at Emmaus House. We've got a course up at the College of New Rochelle. We're doing all these. I just come back at 6 o'clock this morning. I came back from a weekend way out west in New York State working with students from the University of Syracuse and other people from the Syracuse community. You know, we've been doing this at New Paltz, and we've done it at Mount Kisco. We'll be doing it in New Jersey. We'll be doing it next week in Poughkeepsie. We're just going week upon week to high schools and colleges, working for evenings, working for days, getting people turned on to these possibilities. It's very exciting, and this is all, you know, related to what Appleseed is doing.
You gave a talk at the Catholic Worker in which you mentioned that many of today's revolutionaries are repeating the errors of yesterday's revolutionaries.